Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into American political origins and evolving institutions. The Executive Director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also your host for this continuing conversation. Here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid, on this beautiful Tuesday, the 15th day of September, and welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. I just feel so exhilarated. It is such an absolutely perfect day. I trust, you know, that you're having a good day as well, but I know the whole eastern part of the country is quite nice, that, you know, right now. I know I speak to my brother in New England, and he said they're scheduled to have four or five good days in a row like this as well. It's just absolutely spectacular, with the temperature in the low 70s and low humidity and the sky being blue, and it's kind of sad when you look around and you see the leaves beginning to turn. You can see fall everywhere. And of course, when you get up early in the morning, you can feel it as well. But it is absolutely gorgeous, and it's kind of hard to believe that there are places where the temperature's like this most of the time. I know people who have been and spent some time in the San Diego area in Southern California, and say that it's kind of like this there quite often, and I've often thought about it. But I would think that if you had this all the time, you might take it for granted. But after the winter we had last year and some of the issues of the rain we've had this summer and things like that, I don't take it for granted at all. And I think very honestly, as we age, we don't take much for granted. And you know, you take it a day at a time, but you appreciate every one of them. Believe me. Thank you so much for your willingness to be with us on this Tuesday. It is the middle day of September, and I welcome you to the program. And I thank you. I want to remind you that we have a number of ways that you can interact with us. The most direct way is by using our phone number and giving us a call so that we can get you on the air and we can have a conversation about your particular ideas or questions or concerns or comments or whatever. We would love to hear from you. And when I say we, I mean that. It's not just me that would enjoy hearing from you, but I know our other listeners would as well. Our phone number is area code 304-663-4676. 304-663-4676. My email address is waobrien906@gmail.com. W-A-O-Brien, O-B-R-I-E-N, 906, excuse me, all one word, @gmail.com. I remind you also of our Facebook page. The title of the page, of course, is the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution. And if you go to Facebook and you type that in, you will gain access to our page. And there are a number of postings on there of pieces that I have put on there in recent weeks. And most of them, very honestly, are tied pretty much directly to programming that we have done here and issues that we have spent time on here at the Virtual Center. After a particularly good series of issues, or when an issue is really hot in your mind, so to speak, and we spend a day or 2 days or whatever it might be on a particular issue, it seems that sometimes it's just impossible for me to let the issue go without getting it down in writing. And so as a result, much of the writing that I've done, in recent weeks, in the last year, I guess, is tied directly to programming here that we've done on the at the Virtual Center, and some of the research that I've done for it. I mention that because there's a piece that I've been working on, and it's one of those that I was telling my wife, it's a little bit of a struggle, but she kind of chuckles and said, "You say that about everything you everything that you do, and I do that, but I have felt that this one has been a particular struggle for me because it's pretty abstract, and it's a little bit difficult to write it up in ways that make sense and at the same time sound credible. And but I've reached the point where I feel like I've about 80% completed. I've got the body of the article in question pretty much done, and I think the major issue that I'm looking at now is the conclusion, is, you know, and the conclusion that I have in mind is to relate the issues that I think the piece addresses to some of the issues of today in order to hopefully make the thing relevant enough that it'll be of interest to people who might have the opportunity to read it. The reason I mention that, and I think I will be getting into that here at the Virtual Center very, very quickly, is because I'm quite excited about it, because it's something that I have been playing with off and on for several weeks. It's related to Federalist Number 10, very honestly. And you know that we spent so much time here on Federalist Number 10 in the last couple of weeks that the issue is just right at the forefront. I mean, right at the front lobe. And I thought, well, if there's anything worth saying about Federalist Number 10 beyond what we did here at the Virtual Center, now's the time to do it, because the issue is so so prominent in my thinking. And I have come up with something, and I know I mentioned it on a previous program here at the Virtual Center about 3 weeks ago, maybe. It was portion of a program. But over the last week or so, it's been kind of bugging me, and I've gone back and I've played with it over this past weekend, and I think I've got it. And to be honest with you, I'm so excited about it that I actually even shared my theory with a couple of friends over lunch today at a Rotary meeting, and they were kind of chuckling, not because they were that interested in the topic as much as they were interested in my enthusiasm for it. And I think I got a little bit of carried away, but whatever. We were eating salad, so it wasn't messy or anything anyway. And but I really do believe that I have perceived within James Madison's Federalist Number 10, in those portions of the document where people don't spend a whole lot of time or a whole lot of focus, I think I have found hidden there a program or a formula for civic education on the part of James Madison, which would be, if I can successfully justify what I'm arguing, that would be, I think, pretty phenomenal. And I'm quite excited about it. And I'm very anxious to do it in an upcoming program here at the Virtual Center perhaps at the beginning of next week. So again, I remind you of our phone number, area code 304-663-4676. My email address, waobrien906@gmail.com. And our Facebook page, which is entitled The Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution. I also remind you that our previous programs are available on archive. You can go to whiterosesociety.org, or you can go to YouTube, and you can pick up previous broadcasts of programs here at the Virtual Center. Let me alert you to the fact that we will not be presenting a live program here at the Virtual Center tomorrow. In talking with Bob Kincaid before we went on the air today, there's going to be a scheduling issue with the production end of the program. Very honestly, those folks have some responsibilities and an appointment tomorrow, which is going to make it impossible for there to be anybody there to broadcast to produce the program. So therefore, we will not be doing anything live tomorrow in our regular time slot. And so our next live program here at the Virtual Center will be next Monday. And next Monday, I believe, will be the, if I'm not mistaken, will be the 21st of September. So that kind of means that even though we have an abbreviated program today, since it's going to be our last program this week, I've got to do the very best I can to make it meaningful, because I'm not going to be able to go back tomorrow and clean it up any, so to speak. So, again, I remind you, and I'll try to remember to remind you later in the program as well, at least when we sign off at the end of our program today, I'll try to make a mental note to remind you again that we will not be doing a live program here at the Virtual Center tomorrow. If you remember, yesterday, we were back into the relationship or lack thereof between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. And we had talked about some of the issues associated with some of the problems that are associated with trying to make the direct connection between the two. And I made the point that one of the major problems with trying to directly relate the two documents is the fact that they are 11 years apart. They were written 11 years apart, one in 1776, the other in 1787. So consequently, that kind of means that there's 11 years of history in between the two. And the issue comes down to whether, in fact, the Constitution of the United States is directly linked to and driven by considerations and concerns in the Declaration of Independence, or whether, in fact, the Constitutional Convention is more directly related to political and economic issues occurring in the nation during the intervening 11-year period. And I am one of those people who believes that it is the latter. It seems to me that if the Articles of Confederation had worked as it was conceived to work, then there would not have been the move on the part of some, specifically James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, and others that historians have called, for lack of a better term, nationalists, because they are in favor of a strong national government to replace the state sovereignty, the weak central government that exists under the Articles of Confederation. If the weakness of the Articles of Confederation had not presented serious problems to the nation during the 1780s, then there probably would not have been the pressure for change. On the other hand, this is very, very important to keep in mind. We didn't mention this yesterday, but I think it's important. It was an oversight on my part yesterday, but it's something that we have mentioned over and over again in the past, and I think it's particularly appropriate here. And that is that the leading nationalists, Madison and Hamilton and some of the others, were so determined of the need to strengthen the central government and consequently weaken the sovereignty that exists in the state governments that they consciously over-dramatized the problems under the Articles in order to increase the pressure for change. Again, I think it's important to reiterate this because it's very important. There's no question that the Constitutional Conventions met because of real problems that existed in the nation which needed addressing. The agenda for that meeting, for the Constitutional Convention, if you want to call it that, was in Madison's Vices of the American Political System, which he wrote in April of 1787 and shared with his closest friends, in which he laid out 11 of the major issues under the articles that needed to be addressed by the upcoming convention that was scheduled to meet the very next month. So the Vices document realistically almost becomes Madison's agenda for the Constitutional Convention. This is what he thinks has to be accomplished in order for the Constitutional Convention to be successful. All of that is true. But there's absolutely no question that the problems which demanded solution are being blown out of proportion by those who are most adamant about the need for change. And specifically, and I'm not going to go into this today because I think it would take us off our game plan, so to speak. But the most obvious example of that is the so-called Annapolis Convention of September 1786, at which the call for the Constitutional Convention is made by Alexander Hamilton and approved by the majority of the delegates at Annapolis. And you'll recall that there were only five. There were only five states represented at Annapolis. I think there were 11 delegates. And the majority of them are the ones that approved the call for the Constitutional Convention the next May. But we spent quite a bit of time on the Annapolis Convention here at the Virtual Center, and I don't want to go back into that. But it's very obvious that the nationalists, the leaders of that convention, most specifically Madison and Hamilton, were able to manipulate the situation at that convention in order to get the call for the Constitutional Convention, which I think speaks volumes to the degree to which they wanted change in the Articles of Confederation. And in order to do that, they had to frighten other states in order to send delegates to Philadelphia. Only five states showed up at Annapolis. They needed a much better turnout than that if the Constitutional Convention was going to be successful. So, of course, we know that the very same month that the Annapolis Convention met, later in that month, Shays' Rebellion broke out in Massachusetts. And it was blown out of proportion in the newspapers throughout the states, throughout the 13 states, to the point that there was quite a difference between what really happened and what was being reported in the media. In other words, the nationalists' PR machine was quite active with Shays' Rebellion. So I think that's true. Anyway, going back to the issue at hand then, there's absolutely no question in my mind that the Constitution of the United States was more attributable to the events under the Articles of Confederation than it was to a desire to implement the philosophy of the Declaration of Independence. Let me be even more forward, more pointed on that particular issue. Since the Articles of Confederation was drafted at the same time as the Declaration of Independence, and since one can assume that it more closely reflected the thinking of the members of Congress at the time of the Declaration of Independence, then the desire to change the articles, to revise the articles by the nationalists, suggests that the Constitution of the United States was specifically designed to counter and change the philosophy which produced the Articles of Confederation. There was no way that Madison or anybody else could risk tampering with the nation's commitment to Republican government. Madison had said and says in two or three of the Federalist Papers that republicanism was the genius of the American people. It best reflected the priorities and the worldview of the American people. Republican government fit exactly the priorities of the American people in terms of the ideal relationship between government and its citizens. So Madison makes very clear in the Federalist Papers that the Constitution of the United States retains republicanism, retains the nation's commitment to republican government. But I would suggest, and I have suggested and made the case before, it's a quite different view of republicanism than what existed in 1776. So my conclusion would be that the Constitution of the United States is consistent with republicanism, which means that it is directly connected to 1776, but it's committed to a version of republicanism which is substantially different, which suggests that it is not directly connected to the philosophies existent in 1776. So that's the basis of my position that the two documents cannot be linked directly together. At most, at best, they can be indirectly related. And the second thing, and we talked about this yesterday, the second thing that I think is significant here is that it's very clear that Thomas Jefferson himself, in drafting the Declaration of Independence, did not intend to articulate a new philosophy or an ideology for the nation. In fact, the Declaration of Independence says that these things that Jefferson is including in the Declaration are self-evident truths. They are generally accepted principles at the time. And Jefferson's position is that he set out in the Declaration to restate those positions. I apologize for the phone in the background. I won't answer it, and hopefully it'll stop ringing. Basically, Jefferson's position is that his goal is to state the obvious, state the generally accepted, not come out with anything different, anything substantially different. And as I mentioned yesterday, in a letter written to Richard Henry Lee many, many years later in 1825, a year before Jefferson's death, he reiterates that fact, that the goal in the Declaration of Independence was to basically make a statement about what the self-evident truths in the American mind at the time were. Nothing more. So that raises some questions about efforts to try to link the Constitution to the philosophy of the Declaration. Since the philosophy of the Declaration, the author admits, was not new at all, but it was generally accepted ideology of republican government. It's what those who spoke and thought a lot about in terms of republicanism believed had to happen in order for republican government to work. The history of the 1780s revealed, at least to the satisfaction of Hamilton and Madison, that philosophy of republicanism couldn't work and that they had to come up with another one. And the Constitution of the United States does that. So that it seems to me, is the best that I can do in pointing out the similarities and differences between the two documents. But that doesn't close the book on the issue. Because the fact of the matter is, those who are insistent, and I'm talking about politicals today, political ideas and philosophy today, those who are insistent that there is a direct connection between the two documents cannot accept the fact that there might not be. In other words, they must persist in pushing the direct connection between the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, because the philosophy that they subscribe to in today's 20th century America requires that the Constitution of the United States and the Declaration of Independence be connected. Why? Because the priority, the political priority of modern conservatives requires that property be included within Jefferson's unalienable rights. Only if Americans believe that property is an unalienable right, a natural right, that government ought not and cannot tamper with, cannot manage or regulate in any way, only if Americans can accept that, can conservative scholars promote the idea that the issue of America's philosophy is based on the principle of natural rights. In other words, these people's priority is property rights. And the only way that property rights can be included within natural rights is to establish the connection between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. So therefore, they can't let the issue die. They can't allow the issue to be settled. And there's a specific reason for this. And that reason is that they must link Jefferson's thinking in the Declaration to the philosophy of John Locke. Because John Locke's Second Treatise on Civil Government is the philosophical justification for considering property a natural, or in Jefferson's language, an unalienable right. In other words, the only way to make the connection between property and unalienable rights is to base the Declaration of Independence on the philosophy of John Locke. So consequently, I think what we are dealing with here is the reality that the generally accepted explanation of Jefferson's philosophy in the Declaration of Independence is that his ideas, even his language, was taken from John Locke's Second Treatise. The historian most credited and most responsible for that Locke connection to Jefferson is Carl Becker, because in 1922, Carl Becker wrote what has been accepted as the definitive study of the Declaration of the United States. Excuse me, not the Declaration of Independence. I was thinking Constitution. The Declaration of Independence. Becker's book is entitled The Declaration of Independence. The subtitle of Becker's book is The Study of the History of Political Ideas. I'm fumbling through papers here, and I apologize. So the issue related to the Declaration is its connection to John Locke. And Carl Becker's book on the Declaration of Independence is still considered to be the definitive study on the Declaration of Independence. How it was written, how it was worded, where the ideas come, all of it. In his 1920 book on the Declaration of Independence, Carl Becker writes the following, quote, "Americans had absorbed Locke's works as a kind of political gospel, and the Declaration, in its form, in its phraseology, follows closely certain sentences in Locke's second treatise on government. The lineage is direct. Jefferson copied Locke, and Locke quoted Hooker," unquote. That interpretation of the Declaration as Lockean, articulated by and established as truth by Carl Becker, is the basis upon which natural rights philosophers today continue to assume the direct connection between the Declaration and the Constitution of the United States. The issue then is the effort to establish the philosophy of the Declaration of Independence as America's creed. This is what we talked about yesterday with Abraham Lincoln. The idea being that the philosophy of the Declaration as written by Jefferson has become the nation's creed. That's the message. It has become truth in our classrooms, in our textbooks, in our conversation, on our talk shows. And Carl Becker's study of the Declaration of Independence has become so generally accepted as the last word on the Declaration that in the minds of Americans, the issue's closed. The reason that I feel that it's necessary to revisit this issue here in the Virtual Center is because I do not accept the fact that the issue is closed. In fact, I am convinced that the reason the issue is closed is because the political efforts to make this philosophy America's creed involve the repression of all the other alternatives. the only way that this idea of creed related, or, you know, as the definition of the philosophy of the Declaration, the only way that you could sell it as truth is to suppress all the other options. And that's what's happened. Our textbooks directly, if you open any textbook to the section on Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, you will find the linkage to John Locke's second treatise. That means that this is truth as it is being taught to our younger generations. Not only is it being presented that way, but rarely, if ever, is there any mention of the fact that there are other options. And those other options are related to the ideas of the Scottish philosophers that we spent so much time on here at the Virtual Center some months ago. David Hume, Adam Smith, Adam Ferguson, Francis Hutcheson. These philosophies of the Enlightenment dominated 18th century higher education. This Scottish philosophical approach to the Enlightenment dominated the political philosophy being taught at Harvard, at Yale, at King's College in New York, which becomes Columbia, at William and Mary in Virginia, where obviously Thomas Jefferson went to college. The person who taught philosophy to Thomas Jefferson was William Small, who was a graduate of the University of Edinburgh and had studied the ideas of Francis Hutcheson. Hutcheson, it's not Hutchinson, it's Hutcheson, H-U-T-C-H-E-S-O-N, Hutcheson, had studied it in college. When he came to William and Mary to teach philosophy, it was the philosophy of Hutcheson and the Scottish Enlightenment that he taught. And the philosophy of the Scottish Enlightenment denies the connection between Jefferson's Declaration of Independence and John Locke. The philosophy of the Scottish Enlightenment teaches the principle of man's moral sense, of morality being an innate part of man's makeup, man's character, man's nature. It does not deny self-interest in man's nature, but it indicates that within the nature of man exists the competing philosophies, or the competing ideas of self-interest and concern for others. What that means is that the philosophy of John Locke, which includes property as a natural right in the state of nature, implies that when man came out of the state of nature and set up government, property remained a natural right. Therefore, governments acknowledge responsibility to protect men's unalienable rights to life, liberty, And Jefferson said the pursuit of happiness in the minds of these people really means property. The argument, of course, was that Jefferson knew that he could never get the Declaration of Independence through Congress if he put life, liberty, and property in the Declaration. So therefore, he changed property to pursuit of happiness. But these conservatives continue to argue that everybody knew that happiness and property meant the same thing. Because everybody knew that self-interest and the desire for property is what motivated human behavior. And how do we know it? Because John Locke said so. That's the philosophy that modern conservatives who advocate the idea of what they call natural rights philosophy, that's the linkage, that's the connection that they must insist be made in order to promote it, in order to sell it, especially in order to have it accepted as truth. It is necessary to repress the alternatives. It is necessary to repress the realities of the Scottish Enlightenment. It is necessary to repress the influence of the Scottish Enlightenment on Jefferson. Let's look for a moment at the 18th century definition of happiness. A reading of thinking of thought in the 18th century suggests that happiness meant a hell of a lot more than property ownership. In fact, it suggests that the whole idea that man's happiness was tied up with what he owned was absurd. And they rejected it. Instead, if you read the 18th century literature, if you read the philosophies of the Scottish Enlightenment, if you read the writings of Hutcheson and Ferguson, and I'm going to add the writings of Adam Smith because Adam Smith was of this school. The influence of the Scottish Enlightenment on Adam Smith is found principally in his theory of moral sentiments. The emphasis on man's innate sense of morality, his innate idea, a sense of conscience, the idea that man knows right from wrong innately, naturally. He doesn't need to be taught what's right and what's wrong. He knows instinctively what's right and what's wrong. The Scottish philosophers believed this. They wrote about it. They advocated it. They argued for it. And they taught it. And one of the people that they taught was Thomas Jefferson. Consequently, when Thomas Jefferson used the phrase pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence, one has to assume that he was using the word happiness as it was generally used in the 18th century, not as 21st century conservative political leaders and scholars want it to have been used. Lord Kames, one of the more prominent people in the Scottish Enlightenment, refers to happiness this way. Kindness which is done infers a happiness in the person from whom it proceeds, not in him on whom it is bestowed. Happiness is more directly connected to the giver than the receiver. Living your life according to the principles of conscience, the moral sense within you that teaches you what's right and what's wrong, living that life, living in accordance with the innate social conscience within mankind, will lead you to pursue happiness by giving to others. Adam Ferguson, another philosopher of the Scottish Enlightenment, quote, "If the individual owes every degree of consideration to the public, he receives, in paying that very consideration, the greatest happiness of which his nature is capable." Unquote. Happiness is related to the giver, not the recipient. Adam Smith, in his essay on moral sentiments, quote, "All constitutions of government are valued only in proportion as they tend to promote the happiness of those who live under them. By acting according to the dictates of our moral faculties, we necessarily pursue the most effectual means for promoting the happiness of mankind." Unquote. The purpose of government, Adam Smith says, in his essay on moral sentiments, is not to protect private property. The purpose of government is to promote happiness. And the way you measure the success of government is by the degree of happiness that it is able to promote or generate. This is the philosophy that comprised the education of Thomas Jefferson. These are the courses he took. These are the books he read. These are the notes he took in classes. And these are the items that were lost in the 1771 fire that burned down his mother's house in Shadwell, Virginia, in which Jefferson says in his 1771 letter to his friend John Page, "Every paper I had in the world and almost every book was lost. Would to God it had been the money. Then had it never cost me a sigh." Unquote. Jefferson is saying that every note he had, every book he read, with a few exceptions, was destroyed in that fire in 1771. That means that the evidence of the education that Jefferson received in the first 27 years of his life was lost in that fire. Consequently, all we have to go on in order to know what Jefferson believed and what Jefferson meant by the what he said, what he wrote, is to deduce it from the text itself. We have to guess what Jefferson meant by the pursuit of happiness. But it's hard to believe that Jefferson was using happiness as a more acceptable, politically correct word for property. But that's what today's natural rights philosophers must argue, because their agenda is to establish the ideological philosophy of the Declaration of Independence, the ideology expressed in this one paragraph in the Declaration, as America's creed. And we know from the what we looked at yesterday from the pen of Abraham Lincoln that it was Lincoln who was responsible for establishing the philosophy of the Declaration as America's creed. And you'll recall, for those of you that were with us yesterday, that in the last 20 minutes of our program, we were joined by Bob Kincaid, who had some really insightful comments to be made, comments about Lincoln, the lawyer, and raising some serious questions as to whether, in fact, Lincoln saw this philosophy, this creed, as what he really believed, or was he playing lawyer here, and was he using the Declaration of Independence in order to justify the position on the Union that he was basing the North's position on during the Civil War. That, of course, getting into the philosophy of the philosophical priorities and prejudices of Abraham Lincoln is a totally separate issue here, but I think it's very important. So what that means is part of the efforts to sell this American creed is to imply that what Lincoln said in the middle of the 19th century is what Jefferson believed in the 18th century when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. But we know that there's really not all that much in Jefferson's background to suggest that that's what he would have meant at all. But on the contrary, there's a hell of a lot in Jefferson's background to suggest that he meant totally different things in the Declaration than we today choose to give him credit for. All this Scottish philosophy stuff, all the morality, the moral sense, the idea of conscience, all this stuff has been suppressed in favor of the idea that the Declaration of Independence is Lockean. And basically, the proof of that is Carl Becker's 1922 book on the Declaration of Independence, which is considered to be the definitive study. Let me tell you, as an aside, that Carl Becker's Declaration of Independence is available online free. It's considered to be one of those classics. You don't have to buy it. You can get a copy online and read it online. You can print the pages that are most appropriate for the issues that you're looking at. Jefferson's philosophy, Jefferson's background, his use of language, the changes made in the Declaration of Independence during the congressional debates before it was finally passed, the decision by Congress to extract or exclude all the parts of the Declaration related to slavery. And of course, we know, history tells us, that there seemed to be a sense in Jefferson that the Declaration of Independence was a failure because of the changes Congress insisted that that be made in it before it could pass the Congress. And if you've seen the musical 1776, a significant portion of that movie revolves around Jefferson writing the Declaration and the agony that Jefferson goes through because of the changes he's required to make in order to get it approved. And the most agonizing one of all, of course, is the elimination of the slavery provisions that were in Jefferson's original draft of the Constitution. And if you go online, you can find not only the Declaration of Independence, which of course is in the back of every textbook, every American history and political science textbook written, but you can also find online Jefferson's notes on the original draft of the Declaration of Independence, with lines drawn through the words that were changed, or the phrases that were changed, or excluded, or cut out, and all of this. So all of this is a matter of record. And Carl Becker, even in 1922, is able to pick up a lot of this stuff. And there's no question that his book is a classic. It is well worth reading. It is brilliant. The only part of it that we're focusing on here is his assertion that it is taken directly from Locke. Because the fact of the matter is, there's too much evidence to suggest that it probably wasn't. Let me add one more thing here. Because I really believe that it's quite significant. I'm having a senior moment here. I lost my train of thought for a second. And I don't know that I'm going to get it back. So I think that one slipped me. And I apologize. But anyway, I'm sure it'll come back. So again, I know what it was. I know what it was, and it is significant. And that is the fact that one can find in John Locke himself evidence of contradiction that I think is significant. If you read Gary Wills's book, entitled Inventing America, which really focuses on the Scottish Enlightenment approach to the Declaration of Independence, read Carl Becker's Declaration of Independence, and then read Gary Wills' Inventing America, and you'll get both sides. One of the things that Gary Wills points out, and I think it's very significant, is that to deny that Jefferson's declaration is based on Locke's second treatise is not to deny the validity or the importance of John Locke. John Locke is one of the world's greatest philosophers. And Gary Wills points out that in the 18th century, John Locke was considered to be one of the world's preeminent philosophers. But not for the second treatise on civil government. The degree to which Locke's reputation is based on the second treatise on civil government is directly related to the efforts of people in this country to link Jefferson's declaration to that second treatise. But Locke's reputation in the 18th century as one of the world's preeminent philosophers was not based on the second treatise. It was based on his earlier essay on human understanding. That's the essay in which Locke made the very famous argument about tabula rasa, the fact that man comes into the world a blank slate, and that all that man knows is based on what he experiences and what he learns. In other words, the life that he lives records those experiences on this blank slate. And man's development and his education is driven by what he learns. In other words, Locke rejects, in his essay on human understanding, Locke rejects the idea that man came into the world with a genetic makeup, that there were certain things genetically or innately implanted in man before he was born by genes and all that. And we know now with the issues of DNA and all of that, that this is not, that Locke is wrong. But this position of the way that man learns from his environment rather than from what is genetically contained within him is the basis of Locke's reputation in the 18th century. In fact, Gary Wills makes the point that the popularity of Locke's second treatise was based principally on the fact that Locke was already so well thought of because of his essay on human understanding. So to say that Locke was one of the most prominent philosophers in the world at the time is not to be wrong, but to base that reputation on the essay on the second treatise on civil government is wrong. The basis of Locke's reputation was the essay on human understanding and the philosophy of how man learns by his environment and all the rest of it. Okay, here's the point that I was going to make that I had forgotten there for a moment. If you accept Locke's thinking in his essay on human understanding, the idea of tabula rasa, then what that means is that if man came into the world knowing nothing, and that everything man learned and became was a product of what he learned after he was born, the product of his environment, the product of his experiences, then that meant that there is no such thing as a moral sense. There's no such thing as conscience. There's no such thing as an innate ability of man to distinguish between right and wrong, to know truth from falsehood genetically, innately. Rather, what that means is truth has to be something that man learns after he's born. Truth is what's taught to him, not what he's born knowing. That means that if the Declaration of Independence was Lockean, then that would mean that Jefferson would have to accept this whole idea. Jefferson would have to believe that man didn't have a conscience, or that man didn't have a moral sense, or that man wasn't innately able to distinguish right from wrong. If Jefferson was truly Lockean, as Carl Becker says, then Jefferson would have to believe what Locke believed, that there was no moral sense, that there was no conscience in man, that man was totally driven by what he learned. And in this world, what he learns is self-interest and the pursuit of profit. The whole case for free enterprise capitalism in today's world is driven by the belief that man's self-interest is really what motivates him. It's all that matters. That there's nothing else. There's no morality. There's no sense of conscience. There's no sense of right and wrong. There's no sense of doing kindness. Doing kindness to your fellow man makes no sense unless you get something out of it, is the thinking here. So if these folks today are going to insist that the pursuit of profit, the pursuit of wealth, is a natural right, and that the accumulation of wealth and the disgraceful, obscene levels of inequality that exist in society as the result of so few having so much and so many in the world having so little, that these things must be protected, that government's principal responsibility is to protect man's freedom to continue to accumulate. If Jefferson was Lockean, if the philosophy of the Declaration of Independence was Lockean, then one would have to assume that Jefferson believes that. But we know damn well that he didn't. There's too much in Jefferson that tells us that Jefferson never believed this stuff. Jefferson believed in the idea of a moral sense. Jefferson believed, and I'm going back here to the 1787 letter that he wrote to his friend Peter Carr. In 1787, now let's put this into context. 1787 is the year of the Constitutional Convention. 1787 is 16 years after the fire. So all the evidence that we would need to associate Jefferson with the educational background that he had acquired over the 27 years of life before the fire is gone. All we have to go on is what Jefferson left us. his essays, his declaration, his notes on the state of Virginia, his plan for the general diffusion of knowledge in Virginia, his plans for the creation of the University of Virginia in 1818. In other words, we have to basically speculate by looking at what Jefferson did and what he said and what he wrote, and then project back and figure out what he must believe in order to say that. And if you do that, you have to conclude that Jefferson is not a pure Lockean who believes in pure, unadulterated self-interest. You have to believe that Jefferson's meaning in the term pursuit of happiness is not property, but it's it's happiness as the term was generally used in the 18th century, which is about the ability to help others. Jefferson was well read in the writings of the Scottish philosophers. He was well read in the writings and thinkings of Adam Smith. When Adam Smith said in his essay on moral sentiments that all constitutions of government are valued only in proportion as they tend to promote the happiness of those who live under them, Jefferson had to understand that what Adam Smith was saying was that the purpose of government is to promote happiness, not of the few rich, but everybody. The purpose of government is to promote the public interest, the common good, benefits to everybody, not the private wealth of the few. And it is a philosophical stretch of gargantuan proportions for these people today to insist otherwise. There's too much evidence that Jefferson did not buy into this self-interest stuff of John Locke's second treatise. There's too much evidence that Jefferson did not buy in to the writings of John Locke on the idea of tabula rasa. There's too much evidence to suggest that Jefferson did believe in man's sense of goodness, in man's desire to help his fellow man, in man's moral sense, in man's conscience, in man's willingness to do good for others, all of which Locke denied. In the letter to Peter Carr in 1787, which we've looked at before, Jefferson says, and this is a quote, "He who made us, the Creator, would have been a pitiful bungler if he had made the rules of our moral conduct a matter of science." God would have screwed up, I'm putting Jefferson into today's vernacular, God would have royally screwed up if he made the rules of moral conduct in man a matter of science. In other words, a matter of research and experience. Jefferson goes on. Man was destined for society. He was endowed with a sense of right and wrong, merely relative to this. This sense is as much a part of his nature as the sense of hearing, seeing, feeling. It is the true foundation of morality. Unquote. That statement denies the Lockean background of the Declaration of Independence. That statement proves that today's conservative advocates of natural rights philosophy, but more specifically the inclusion of property in it as a natural right, as an unalienable right, to be fallacious. It doesn't hold up. It is invalid. Consequently, it seems to me we have to go back to the drawing board. We have to look at the founders again. We have to delve more deeply into what they said and what they believed and what they argued and what they knew. We can't trust those with their own political agenda to tell us what the hell truth is. And we have to stand up against efforts to try. Here's a problem. We're down to, we've got 10 minutes to go, and less than 10 minutes to go on today's program, so I don't want to get into anything totally new. But I think a good place to go from where we are is to look at the Constitution of the United States, which was drafted 11 years after the Declaration. And one of the things that we are forced to deal with is the influence of the Scottish philosophers on James Madison, the architect, the father of the Constitution of the United States. Madison's education was received, his college education was received at Princeton University. The president of Princeton at the time of Madison's attendance was John Witherspoon. John Witherspoon came to this country from Scotland. John Witherspoon was not only a product of the philosophies of Hutchison and the rest of them. John Witherspoon was an advocate of this philosophy. John Witherspoon was the basis of Madison's entire undergraduate reputation at Princeton, plus the year of postgraduate study that Jefferson conducted after he graduated from Princeton, personally from John Witherspoon. Madison was not a devotee, an advocate of the dark side of human nature. Madison believed that man was more than self-interested, greedy, profit-motivated, property-driven, that there was much more to man than that. Therefore, the whole idea that Madison was driven by self-interest, by human nature that totally dominated and controlled human behavior, is fallacious. But again, we have to believe that. We have to basically paint Madison into that corner if we are going to insist that the philosophy of the Constitution is directly connected to the philosophy of the Declaration of Independence. What it required is that we alter both of them. We had to basically alter the definition or the view of the Declaration by suppressing the Scottish Enlightenment. We have to promote the greedy, profit-driven, self-interested view of the Constitution in order to make it consistent with what we want the Constitution to become, which is the instrument to implement the self-interest, the property-driven self-interest in the Declaration of Independence that Jefferson really meant when he said property, when he said pursuit of happiness, namely property. What all of this suggests is the need to go back to the drawing board. We've got to revisit the sources. We've got to rethink how we teach this stuff. We've got to be more aware of what it is we are telling our students to be true. We have got to find a way to educate our young people by opening up the possibility of different ideas, not closing their mind to the acceptance of only one idea. How we teach our young is driven by the same goals, the same objectives that drive natural rights philosophers to try to rewrite the past in order to justify their definition of the right present. It is, in terms of good scholarship, it is dishonest. It is unfair. It is class-based. It is demeaning to the average citizen, not only of this country, but the majority of people on the face of this earth. It basically becomes the justification for abusing the environment, of decimating the planet, of polluting the air. Of dirtying its water. All the things that the Pope talked about in his encyclical early this summer are a product of an interpretation of truth that is being pushed and perpetrated and funded by big money. And it's got to be stopped. It's got to be turned around. And the only way to begin the process of making that possible, I would argue, is to retain and maintain outlets like the Head On Radio Network. Places where it's possible to get out the other part, the other story. We can't continue to allow these people to control what's in our textbooks and then impose what's in them as if it were truth on our young people and destroy their ability to ask questions, destroy their willingness to doubt, destroy their belief that there is truth. But most important of all, to destroy their willingness to believe that they have the ability to pursue truth for themselves. And that they are not required to accept the definition of truth from those who have the power over them. That's not what the founders were about. That's not what Jefferson was about. That's not what the philosophy of the Scottish Enlightenment was about. And damn it, it's not what the Constitution was about either. And when we continue these programs next week and we get in back into Madison again, we're going to find a Madison that's going to blow our socks off, I believe. Because we're going to introduce a James Madison that, for the most part, does not exist in this country. But I think there's evidence to suggest that he's really there. He's really in Federalist number 10. We're at 59 minutes after the hour, and we finished our program today on this Tuesday. Let me thank you for tuning in, and let me remind you again that we will not be doing a live program on the Virtual Center tomorrow. I will put a notice this evening on Facebook to that effect. Our next program will be next Monday at 1 p.m. at our regular time, and the topic will be James Madison and a reading of Federalist number 10 that I think is pretty exciting. I hope you'll agree. This is Bill O'Brien. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you share the Virtual Center and the Head On Radio Network with those that you know and those that you work with. Thank you again. Be safe. And enjoy. Thank you.